of the day is United States against Rogan, the appeal of Whitlaw. Mr. Barron.
May it please the court, Steve Barron on behalf of the Whitlows and the estate of Whitlow, the appellants. It's not often a case that is cited by both parties for some of the principal points. It was decided by the very panel that we appear before, so I thought I would focus for a moment on the Kalinsis decision, U.S. v. Kalinsis. I think there's some parallels, and I think there's some differences between the two cases. In Kalinsis, of course, there was a $25 million order of restitution entered against a criminal defendant, Mr. Kalinsis. The government then issued collection proceedings and started a garnishment, and Mrs. Kalinsis subsequently filed for divorce in Indiana. And thereafter, she asserted rights in certain property that was being garnished pursuant to the Federal Debt Collection Practices Act. All of the assets, as far as the case seemed to suggest, were in the name of Mr. Kalinsis. As I understand your holding in that case, you dealt with some procedural issues not of the moment here, namely that a garnishment can issue through a criminal proceeding and that Mrs. Kalinsis was, in fact, an interested person, although she suggested she was an intervener. But of the moment is the court's finding that the government, because it had a previously perfected lien before Mrs. Kalinsis filed for a divorce, thereby trumped any rights that she had in the subject property. What are the distinctions that we see? Number one, in that case, the government had a perfected lien. They had filed a notice, and the lien was indeed perfected. Here, the government does not have a perfected lien, and to the extent they had any lien in the subject condominiums, they released that lien in order to allow the condominiums to be sold.
I hate to interrupt you, but I'm going to. Whatever claim that the Whitlows had to the escrowed funds, they had never reduced that claim to a judgment. Given the government's status as a judgment creditor, why isn't that just the beginning and end of this case?
Well, that's certainly what Judge Dara found, but I think that that's a wooden approach here.
A what?
A wooden, W-O-O-D-E-N, a wooden approach. That, in fact, first of all, we assert that the government, although they were a judgment creditor for some of the funds at issue, namely a collection of $2.1 million and $1.8 million, that there were other funds that were still in the Darby escrow, which is the subject escrow here, that were not the subject of the government's judgment from Judge Dara and were otherwise available to the Whitlows in order to recover their claim. But
they weren't the only claimant.
True, they weren't the only claimant, but the issue was Judge Dara found they had no interest at all and simply leaped over to the conclusion that because the government was a judgment creditor and the Whitlows were, in theory, general unsecured creditors, that that trumps everything. And our point is that at least as to part of those funds, the government did not have any superior rights. And, in fact, we also assert that the government effectively stepped into the shoes as an owner of the 410 entity that owned the condominiums, and therefore the Whitlows jump ahead of the government, at least with respect to the balance of the funds that remained in the Darby escrow. In any event, Judge Dara did not see any of this.
He just simply why did they jump ahead of the government?
Yeah.
I thought you were saying that they have whatever priority of interest is provided by Georgia law, because 410 Montgomery was an entity organized under Georgia law. And that may be ahead of the government or it may be behind the government. There are hints in the, at least in the government's brief, that your client may have been a stalking horse for Rogan. And if so, your client's claim would be behind the government's. But is anything in your view turn on this ahead of the government position as opposed to whatever priorities they have under Georgia law?
Yeah, I think our point there, Your Honor, is that if the government is a de facto owner of the 410 enterprise, as opposed to a judgment creditor, that they stand behind other creditors, namely, for example, the Whitlows, who get to collect on the balance of the funds that were in the Darby escrow after the government tapped the 1.8 and the 2.9. So any owner of an LLC that is being liquidated, in essence, has to stand behind creditors of the LLC. So we are asserting that there is the possibility that the government here is, in effect, the owner of the LLC and must stand behind other creditors.
I thought, well, I will obviously pursue this with Mr. Stewart, too, but I thought your position was that the government is a creditor of Rogan, not a creditor of 410 Montgomery LLC, and that your position was that district court's error was treating the government as if it were a creditor of 410 Montgomery rather than a creditor of Rogan.
Correct.
And that there are different sets of rules that apply depending on what the government is a creditor of.
That is correct. That is correct. And Judge Dara didn't see that as a meaningful difference and did not look to Georgia law or even give us the opportunity to have a hearing on that to determine whether we had any either superior rights or at least on par rights with the government for the balance of the funds that were in the escrow. So, we think that his approach and his application of the Kalinsis decision in this case was unduly restrictive. He seemed to suggest that because the Whitlows did not own did not have an ownership interest in the subject assets, that therefore they lose. And I think the Federal Debt Collection Practices Act is broader than that. It doesn't require, nor did your holding in Kalinsis seem to suggest, that one had to have an ownership interest in the underlying assets. Simply had to have an interest. And here their interest was as creditors. They were essentially involved in an enterprise that lent money to the condominium, and they were owed that money. And they had a legitimate creditor interest in that. So I guess one last point on that is that in any event, the other point I think overlooked by Judge Dara is that Jerry Whitlow was the escrow agent of the Darby escrow, which, again, the government agreed was governed by Georgia law. And under that law, Mr. Whitlow would have an ownership interest in the escrowed funds. So, in fact, even under Judge Dara's configuration and his analysis, there is an ownership interest that inures to the benefit of at least Mr. Whitlow. So what we're asking from this court is to send the case back to Judge Dara to apply the appropriate state law analysis. The cases that have construed the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act seem to suggest that there is an effort to, and there should be an effort to, look to state law on some of the merits and not just the procedure.
Speaking of efforts to rely on state law, there's something that puzzles me about your brief and about the government's brief, and that is that neither brief cites United States against Kimball Foods. Is there some reason for that omission?
I'm not aware, Your Honor.
United States against Kimball Foods holds that the government's priority as a creditor in private assets depends on state law. It's very strongly supportive of your position. It's totally inconsistent with the government's position, and neither side cites it. It's a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court. One might think that Kimball Foods would be fairly important in this case.
Sounds to me like it is. And underscores the point that we've made with or without Kimball, obviously, that we need to look to state law here. Judge Dara did not do that, and that's what he needs to do if and when the case is sent back to him on remand. Thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Barron. Mr. Stewart.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, the United States initiated garnishment proceeding against property belonging to Peter Rogan. It was the first creditor, judgment creditor.
You see, I think that's the problem here. You issued garnishment orders to get property belonging to Peter Rogan. Don't we therefore have to determine what property belonged to Peter Rogan and what property belonged to Whitlow?
That was determined in the summary judgment proceedings that preceded
what Judge Darris said is, as I understand it, since the United States got legal process first, it gets this property whether it belonged to Rogan or to Whitlow.
The Whitlows never had any interest in this property. They had no interest in 410 Rogan's Montgomery.
Interest no in interest in an LLC that invested in 410 Montgomery LLC.
So
if you're trying to give the property to its owners, you know, Rogan gets whatever percentage interest in 410 Montgomery LLC is his. The other investors get theirs. Now, Whitlow claims to be an investor in one of those investors.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Suppose this were not 410 Montgomery LLC, but the Merchandise Mart.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And suppose what had happened is Rogan takes his $65 million in ill-got gains and he uses it to buy 1% of the Merchandise Mart. The United States realizes that that's where he's stashed the money.
Right.
And issues a garnishment order against the Merchandise Mart.
Okay.
And then insists that the Merchandise Mart be sold. Right?
Right.
Just as what happened to 410 Montgomery.
Okay.
Is it your view that the United States is now entitled to the entire value of the Merchandise Mart because it got a garnishment order before anybody else did?
Absolutely.
Now, of course, the
not.
Reason nobody else got a garnishment order is that the Merchandise Mart didn't owe anybody.
That's right.
Anything.
And Your Honor, the United States would recover to the extent that Peter Rogan had an interest in the Merchandise Mart.
The value of Peter Rogan's interest in the Merchandise Mart.
Exactly.
But as I understand Whitlow's argument, that's exactly what failed to happen here, that the United States has been held to be entitled to more than Peter Rogan's interest in 410 Montgomery.
Not at all. And I'll explain why. And the reason why is that it was very clear, first of all, 410 Montgomery was owned by the trusts that were established offshore for the Rogan children. We'd refer to them as the Belizean Trusts.
Mm-hmm.
They had, the 99% interest in 410 Montgomery. The Whitlows, on the other hand, had no interest in 410 Montgomery. They, at best, through Taylor Rowe, were an unsecured creditor of 410 Montgomery. They made a loan. They could have taken a precaution to secure that loan by taking some security interest in 410 Montgomery. They didn't do that. So what the United States proved below was that there was two revenue streams coming off of 410 that Peter Rogan would benefit from. First of all, he would benefit from a loan his offshore Bahamian trust made to 410 Montgomery, and would also benefit from the investment made through the sham Belizean trusts that were set up in his children's name.
Come back to the Merchandise Mart.
Okay.
You are surely not saying that if the Merchandise Mart is, say, 10% equity and 90% debt, where the 90% has been loaned by a bank syndicate, and Peter Rogan invests in some of the equity interests of the Merchandise Mart,
mm-hmm.
that the United States could collect the whole $65 million and shut out the banks because they're just lenders and they didn't get a judgment against the Merchandise Mart before the United States got a judgment against Rogan.
They would have
the
a
banks
security
had
interest.
No reason to get a judgment against the Merchandise Mart because it wasn't in default on any loan. Right? You began by saying the United States gets whatever Rogan owned. It doesn't get to say we cut out the banks and any of their capital, you know, their 90%, we can grab because they didn't get prior attachments. They had no reason to get attachments.
They had no security interest.
Look, the other way to look at this is you're treating this as if the Whitlows wanted dibs on some of Rogan's assets. And if that were so, then the fact that the U.S. got legal process against Rogan first, U.S. wins hands down.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If the Whitlows were a creditor, had loaned money to Rogan, and Rogan had stiffed them, U.S. wins hands down. No problem.
Right.
But that's not the nature of their argument, as I understand it. The nature of their argument is that they put money into 410 Montgomery, and all they want the district court to do is to make sure that this fund is segregated so that the U.S. gets no more than what Rogan would have gotten had there been a private dissolution.
Well, Your Honor, their remedy in that case would not be to try to intervene in a garnishment proceeding, but rather to initiate insolvency proceedings under Georgia law for a windup of 410 Montgomery. keep in mind that the primary assets of 410 Montgomery, all of the assets of 410 Montgomery were sold.
There is a REIS. The REIS is subject. It's this fund. It's a REIS. It's subject to the jurisdiction of the federal court.
Mm-hmm.
An important principle of law that a Georgia court can't assert jurisdiction over a REIS that's within the federal court's jurisdiction.
Okay.
It's known as in rem jurisdiction.
Right.
Just can't happen. What you're suggesting they should have done, they couldn't possibly have done.
At the very least, they could have established their interest, Judge, in an appropriate proceeding, but a garnishment proceeding is not that.
And you have to make your claim against the REIS in the court with the jurisdiction over the REIS. That's just the way the world works.
Well, Your Honor, that may very well be true. In any event, the Whitlows had an opportunity. Keep in mind that these assets were sold in January of 2007. The Whitlows didn't do anything to reduce their claim to a judgment. Nothing at all. Not even when these garnishment proceedings were going on in federal court. They did nothing to try to prove up their claim. We still don't know whether or not they have a valid claim against 410 Montgomery or against Peter Rogan.
This is one of the places where you lose me. They don't have a claim against 410 Montgomery. If you're an investor in an LLC.
They are not an investor in an LLC. They lent money to an LLC.
You can force me to say over and over, an investor in an investor in an LLC. If you want to force me to say it and consume your time, that's fine. They are an investor in an investor in the LLC.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any legal claim against it until it liquidates and doesn't pay them. What kind of lawsuit is it you think they should have filed and gotten a judgment against them?
They could have obtained a judgment against 410 Montgomery.
But 410 Montgomery didn't violate any of their rights.
They didn't pay the money that they were entitled to.
You're entitled only to a distribution from the fund. If Corporation X dissolves, no one can sue Corporation X. You can sue only if it doesn't pay you your portion of the fund. Right? And that's all they wanted. There wasn't any claim that 410 Montgomery had defaulted on a legal obligation to them. You got a writ that required 410 Montgomery to pay the money into the federal court, and that's the forum in which the claims would be adjudicated. There wasn't any separate wrong committed against any of the investors.
Well, Your Honor, once again, This was a garnishment proceeding. The Whitlows never established an interest in the res that you're speaking to. They never established an interest in this property, and that was a threshold issue that they needed to make that showing before they could make any sort of claim to this property. They would have done that if they had reduced their claim to a judgment, and then by being a judgment creditor, they could have made a claim against the assets of 410 Montgomery. So I think that's a significant point that's being lost here, and that's in cold.
One thing you might be saying is that the Whitlows aren't the real party in interest, that only their LLC would be the real party in interest, the LLC through which they invested in the 410 Montgomery LLC.
Mm-hmm. No. Well,
is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. I think what we're saying is that the Whitlows sought to take a shortcut here. In many ways. They didn't have a judgment against 410 Montgomery. They didn't even have a claim to some extent, they didn't have a claim to be made even on their own behalf. They were making it through Taylor Rowe. And so instead of doing all the right things, getting authority to file on behalf of Taylor Rowe, reducing their claim to judgment, you know, and getting a right to seek
what
the assets.
What sort of a judgment would Taylor Rowe have gotten against 410 Montgomery? For breach of what duty?
They lent money to Taylor Rowe, lent money to 410 Montgomery, and with the non-payment of that money, there would have been a breach of contract action or something else.
So there was a default on the loan.
Or default on the loan, yes. But there was no security interest. The loan was not secured by any security agreement. They were an unsecured creditor of 410 Montgomery. And this is the priority in this case is established by federal law. It is established under the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act, which says that the first writ is granted priority.
That's the priority in Rogan's assets. But the whole problem here is that you appear to be claiming a priority in assets that were payable to somebody other than Rogan.
And, Your Honor, but for our writ of garnishment, these assets would have been whisked offshore to Mr. Rogan's Bahamian Trust and to his children's Belizean Trust and been out of reach. But for the government's action in this case, there would have been nothing to argue about.
That's just completely irrelevant. That doesn't tell you what portion of the fund belongs to Rogan.
The court decided that these monies
belongs to somebody else.
And the district court decided with that these monies were intended for, and were going to go to Peter Rogan, but for the government's action.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Anything further, Mr. Barron? That's for sure.
I just want to respond to the government's position that the Whitlows didn't do anything to try to prove up their claim. We did. It's just that Judge Darrow found that we had no interest, and we find that that was an inappropriate ruling, given his failure to look to the relevant law.
The United States was hinting at something that troubled me when I read the briefs, which is, why is your client the right party to be making this claim rather than Taylor Rowe? Because the investment is technically made by Taylor Rowe, and your client then claims an interest in Taylor Rowe.
A couple of points. One is that there are two distinctive There are two distinctive types of claims. There's a claim by Jerry Whitlow and Diane Whitlow for services they rendered to the development, and that's
that apparently has been given up. It hasn't been quantified.
Well, that was part of the problem. We never were able to do that in the trial court. And the second claim is part of the owner is the ownership claim that you're alluding to, Your Honor, which is via the Taylor Rowe entity. And Taylor Rowe has filed a separate claim in the proceeding below, and it was never adjudicated by Judge Darrow in the summary judgment proceeding.
And why are you the right party? Right, this sounds kind of like an investor's derivative suit on behalf of Taylor Rowe. I have no idea what, under Georgia law, the requirements are for derivative litigation on behalf of an LLC.
Yeah. We address that, I think, at page 8 of our reply brief, but essentially we say that there's nothing that requires under Georgia law that we bring a derivative action at this juncture.
Yeah, but what allows you to bring an action on behalf of Taylor Rowe?
The ownership interest that they have in Taylor Rowe.
Yeah. That's just to say it's derivative, and normally one thinks of derivative actions as something that exists only when authorized by law. But the U.S. hasn't really jumped on this point. Okay, well, I think I see the parties' positions.
Thank you,
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the court